from the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. You're listening to CJUM 101.5 FM, your hit-free radio station.
And good afternoon. It is a nice sunny Sunday afternoon, July the 24th, after a pretty miserable rainy weekend. And you're listening to West End Dumplings, the radio edition on 101.5 UMFM. And welcome back. So this is West End Dumplings, the radio edition, and I'm your host, Christian Cassidy. And today, my guest is screenwriter and novelist Jeff Amey.
Hello.
Hello, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Great, great. And his novel, No Escape from Greatness, from Turnstone Press, was released just a couple of months back.
That's right.
It's technically not your first novel.
No, that's
but
true.
But you seem to have hidden away
that's
information
right.
about your
so,
first two novels.
Yeah, it's very misleading, but I'm calling it my literary debut because my first two, I did self-publish a couple of novels, but they were teen zombie novels that were like, you know, dash them off during the National Novel Writing Month and kind of, you know, get them out and see what happens.
Okay.
And,
so you're
learn.
So this is your literary debut.
That's right.
Now,
that's
some
right.
full disclosure, Jeff and I worked together back in the good old 90s.
A moon ago.
Yeah,
yes.
And
when I had hair.
I remember reading, oh, me too. I remember reading your four sentence media advisories and thinking, you know what, if this guy, you know, puts his mind to it, you know,
he can put more words
there
together.
There could be a novel in there. So. And so we kind of lost track after that job. And then next time I heard you kind of pop up, you were a screenwriter.
Okay.
Of
yep.
all things, which yep. is, I'm sure more things happened in between there, but but at least from my perspective, that's where I next heard you. You were doing some screenwriting, which is kind of, it's kind of like heart surgeon. There's like not too many people in Winnipeg can.
No, that's true.
And
there are even fewer who are actually self-sustaining. So, and I'm not one of them. But yes, I guess it probably would have been. It's almost 10 years ago now. I kind of took a good hard look in the mirror and realized that, you know, I was playing around at this, you know, fiction writing stuff and screenwriting, and I've always loved TV and movies, and so I decided to like really rededicate and try, right? Like mm-hmm. try for real. So started educating myself and through here at the University of Manitoba and other places like UCLA actually has a great program that you can access anywhere in the world. And just started doing it and writing movies and television shows and managed to get some work as kind of a baby screenwriter or a story assistant. On a couple of shows that were in production in Winnipeg, including one called Less Than Kind, I guess.
Yes.
That was some very good fortune being able to work on the final two seasons of that show. And it was directly related to the fact that poor Maury Chaykin had passed away. Yeah. And so they, at the very last moment for the third season, they had to rip up 13 episodes of the TV show rewrite them as a writer's room, and they could use all the help they could get. And so I had a friend who was in that group and said, we could really use an assistant. Can you work for peanuts? And I said, I dropped everything and went to work for 6 weeks. And it was so much, such a rewarding experience. It's fun and lots of sweat. And a TV production of any type is just, you know, 12 to 14 hour days for weeks at a time.
Starting
and
at like 5 a.m, right?
Yeah, it changes constantly because because of union rules, like if you start at noon and then go till 12:30 after midnight, it's a typical 12-hour day plus a little bit of overtime, but you can't start until 12 hours later. So the next day it's 12:30 or 1 o'clock would be your call time,
okay.
And then you're pushing everything, right? And so over the course of a five-day week, you could end up, the first day might be noon till midnight, and then the fifth day might be 3 p.m. till 3 a.m. Or, you know, if they need daytime or they need nighttime, that could affect production too. So it just sucks up your life while you're doing it. It's amazing.
And what was it like? Like you were saying it was kind of a story room. So what's that compared to like one guy sitting down at a keyboard? Right.
Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of people with TV shows sort of imagine that it's a collection of people who are in their own personal offices or rooms or whatever. And, you know, the name that you see written by the credit is the person who actually wrote that show. But TV writing is a team sport. And there's a writer's room, usually with a showrunner who is the executive producer. And those people are becoming celebrities now. Ours was a celebrity to begin with in Mark McKinney, who you know, everyone knows from Less Than Kind and also Slings and Arrows and is now acting on a show called Superstore. And Mark is, you know, fantastic and so skilled. And so he led the team. And then there was a team of of, I think there was about a half dozen writers that worked as a group to kind of plot okay. out how every episode in the season would go. And then they were assigned episodes to actually put, you know, there was kind of an outline for the episode, and then they would turn it into script form, bring it back to the team. The team would go through it. And some people have expertise like in, you know, gags. And so they would sort of give it a pass and make sure that it was punched up for all the comedy. And some people were more character people or dialogue people or whatever. So everyone brought skills to the table. Okay. And for me, I was just a story assistant. I was helping sort of keep everybody on pace and track the deadlines and connect the writer's room with the rest of the production. So the floor, it's called, like the studio okay. floor, because actors and directors need to see the latest changes to every script. So there's lots and lots of work to do and a lot of coordination that needs to happen. So I was helping out with all that. And then in the final season, I worked with a woman named Jen Beasley, who and we both were the story coordinators on the final season. And I actually didn't get credited for it, but actually got to write the final scene of the series.
Oh, really?
There's like the credits roll, and then we come back to a little like jokey bit, and Mark let me take the pen on that one.
That's great.
Yeah, it was fun. It was just such an amazing experience, and great people to work with too. But so intense.
Now that show, of course, is.
It is gone.
Because HBO picked it. Like, it had near-death experience, right?
And then
HBO
picked it up. A-Channel was the first home for it. And then after they actually had a second season in the can, and A-Channel decided it wasn't for them and sold it to it's actually HBO Canada and the Movie Network together. Oh. So it gets a first run on HBO and then subsequently on the Movie Network. And that's how it operated. They used the second season that was already in the can, and then they produced third and fourth seasons specifically for HBO Canada. So they got a lot more adult and raunchy and also more hilarious, I think. So
yeah, well, it's a show that is, obviously not too many shows shot in Winnipeg, and I think it had a special place in a lot of people's hearts. And
And the city is the city. It's not masquerading as Chicago or anything like that. It's about a family in North End Winnipeg, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, exactly. Yeah. And there aren't too many. I mean, I know, what was the last show I was watching a bunch of episodes of? The Pinkertons.
Yep.
Which I think is shot in Manitoba, but it's disguised as Kansas City. So
yep.
And then Sunnyside?
Yep, Sunnyside.
Now, that was a web only.
Nope, Sunnyside was on it? City TV, yep.
Okay.
Yep. And they got, I believe, two full seasons. Yeah. So, and alas, I believe.
Yeah.
Sunnyside is no more.
Yeah, but for Winnipeg, it's and I think even the Pinkertons, I think they were still shopping around last I saw for someone to pick up another season.
I got to be extra in three episodes of that show.
Oh.
And that was super fun because it was, period piece. So you got to wear the costumes and stuff and, hang out in a saloon and pretend. I think I was, looked a little bit like a rabbi for one episode. And then I was just kind of a rank and file Kansas City resident who liked his beer and liked to flirt with saloon girls.
Oh, I'll have to keep that in mind next when I see them come back and come back in reruns.
Yeah, yeah.
So the shows, I mean, obviously there are, it's not like, say, Toronto or Vancouver or LA where you got, a dozen shows maybe going at the same time here. So, but you were able to stay in Winnipeg for Less Than Kind. So all that production was kind of done here. It wasn't written in Toronto and then shipped out here. And
It's a combination. So most of the writers do, like, if you want to work as a screenwriter full time, living in Toronto is the best way to do it in Canada. Obviously, LA would be even more preferable if you want to stay busy. Mm-hmm. But they would kind of do the pre stuff in Toronto. And, it was easy enough to connect in for that. It's not quite the group activity in the early stages. So they may meet as a group, as a writer's room, maybe once or twice, but they're just communicating and getting stuff going. And then as production ramps up in Winnipeg, for that, because all the scripts got ripped up for season three, there was a lot more activity as a writer's room.
Oh, okay, sure.
And then for the fourth season, there was, I think things were about kind of half cooked and not as many writers came along. So they brought, I think, two writers in for the final season. just for last minute changes and polish and that kind of stuff. And the creators of the show were also directors and producers for that, so they were around as well. And
okay. So you had a lot of people to consult about.
Oh yeah,
and they were here on the ground in Winnipeg for
for weeks on end. Yep.
So with now, the CRTC is kind of been fiddling with CanCon rules for television. Mm-hmm. We're going way off on an aside here from writing books, but you know, I think lessening the amount of CanCon on kind of regular network television.
Yes.
And some of the argument is that, well, there's so many platforms out there now, and so many different services that you can get.
Yep.
You know, a quote unquote TV show, which I guess you can't really call them. I guess a short video production or whatever that is going to more than make up for, you know, having to have these, you know, more traditional TV networks kind of put aside X number of hours every week. I mean, what do you see as you know, the present and the future of CanCon and people like yourself who want to script write for Canadian television?
Well, there's loads and loads of change. And, you know, as a viewer, I know that the way that I watch TV is completely changed, you know. With streaming, you know, Netflix and the Canadian versions of that are, you know, big factors. But also, we don't necessarily feel, I think as an audience, you don't feel like you need to see something that's exactly 30 minutes long anymore or 60 minutes long. You can watch it 10 minutes at a time. You may watch it on YouTube. You may download files. You may do whatever it is. And you know, the origin of the show isn't necessarily that important to you. But also, Canadian productions are as good as any in the world. And so the hand up isn't as required as it used to be, I think.
Okay. Just because there are more ways to get your
stuff
out
and
there.
Things are changing, like with a la carte channels. That's going to change. That's, you know, making our broadcasters very nervous. And so they don't want to risk a whole bunch of money on productions that may not get watched. And so some of the niche channels are, you know, in jeopardy and probably not going to be able to offer the amount of programming that they have historically. So everything is in a state of flux. But that may not be a bad thing. It's just an uncertain thing, and big businesses don't like uncertainty. I think still, if there was a really good show that happened to have Canadian influence, X Company immediately comes to mind. X Company, a co-production with, I believe, a couple of European production companies.
Yeah.
If you've never seen it, go watch it. It's a fantastic show. You know, the fact that it's about Canadians during World War II is kind of a bonus. It's just a good show. And I think that quality will always win out like that, as long as people are able to hear about it and know about it.
Yeah, so you think people, Canadian, you know, producers, writers, directors will be able to use these new services to their advantage?
Yeah, I think so too. And I do think that. Okay. And, you know, I'm as a Manitoban, what I see is, you know, we have a great tax credit here for film and TV productions that really helps bring productions into the province. The one thing that it doesn't do is encourage the creators to originate from this province. So what we're doing importing the business, but not necessarily creating something that's a quote unquote Manitoba product in that kind of intellectual sense.
Sure. So that's all these, you know, Hallmark movie of the weeks.
Yeah.
That,
yeah,
you know,
we get those
get shot here. They're set in Chicago or Kansas City or...
Yeah, absolutely. And other provinces are losing their tax credits, and so we're becoming more and more preferred among, you know, with all those productions that are out there. And we have some great companies in Manitoba and Winnipeg specifically that are fantastic host producers, like Buffalo Gal Pictures and many others. So not meaning to include or exclude anyone, but we have lots of great infrastructure here, and they do support Canadian or Manitoba artists and Manitoba creators as well. But there's no real financial incentive to do it. They're doing it because they want to do it. So it would be great to see some little tweaks in that regard. But again, with CanCon and all the government stuff, I mean, I'm not a big believer that you should rely on those things. They're kind of bonuses if you can get them. So
okay. Now your book, which we're going to get to, but No Escape from Greatness, mm-hmm. started out as a screenplay.
Yeah, that's right. I was developing a TV series, and I had written a pilot, and I had plans for episodes, and I was really sort of looking at some personal truths in that show. And at the time I was calling it Return to Greatness, and it was about the town, and it was about this kind of egomaniac coming back to a small town and being stuck there. And partway through developing this show, and I thought, you know what, I wouldn't mind like novelizing this. I'd like to get deeper. And it's not just a sitcom, but I'd like to get a little further with it.
And that's so if I was to sit down and say, read the screen written version of the book, is that's one of the big differences? You get to do that. You get to go deeper in a novel.
Yeah. I've been saying that you get this one camera angle with a book that you can't get with screenplays, that zooms directly into the character's brain, right? Okay. And you can kind of like hear their voice in a different way, and hear how they're thinking or how they're observing things. And it's it is a little bit of an advantage, but also there are some pace things, and I think. I've really had to make the story in the book more gentle. I think that movies and TV shows can be a little more cruel and like a little less politically correct, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know if that's really the right word, but like it's a little more crass on a screen. You can get away with a bit more without offending people. I do think that. I don't know if that's the medium itself or if it's just what we expect as an audience, but I think it's a little more gentle in the book too. Probably the characters are probably a little more human. That's probably.
And now Turnstone Press has published this. Now, did you have a publisher first and then go, or did you write the book and you just, for anybody who's listening out there thinks, God, I'd love to write a book. How did that process work with you?
I sent Turnstone a query and said, I have a story idea for you, and I'm about to, you know, I can get you three chapters in a few weeks kind of thing. And they said, yeah, that's a concept we'd be interested in looking at. So once I had their interest, then I sent in sample chapters. So about a third of a book of the book in the end. I sent in as a sample. They said, yes, let's see a first draft. And then after the first draft is when we started talking about contract. So, but having that conversation was good, and having a bit of a rapport and making sure that you're actually, you know, delivering something that the writing, I guess, has to be a certain quality, but also the concept has to be something that they think, oh, well, you know, we can actually sell some books here.
No, absolutely. Which is, I guess, a different mindset from, you know, the self-publishing thing, which has become more and more popular, where you can, you know, it's almost like a big version of a bigger, more expensive version of a blog, which is what I do, because I can write about whatever I want and I don't really care who reads it, or I'm doing it for myself. I'm done putting my research on a page, and, you know, hopefully people will find it on the internet. And for some, not everyone, I mean, some people take the same professionalism in self-publishing that they would if they were, you know, if it was being published by a big company. But that's got to be a little, you know, a little different discipline. You have somebody looking over your shoulder or something, you know?
Being published is such a pleasure and I guess a privilege, because you have people helping you and making what you can create better with, you know, there's the editing process, which, you know, is probably, I'm guessing this book is probably 300 or 400% better because my editor, Sharon Caseberg, did such a great job of actually pushing me to you know, get it into a direction that is easier to read and also is a more complete, compelling story. And that was great. And then you've got, you know, all the marketing aspects of it. And so unless you're that special kind of person that is able to design a book and self-edit a book and market a book, you're probably going to be better off having a team supporting you.
Yeah. Okay.
And I feel very privileged to be able to actually be published, especially, and, you know, self-publishing two books is a good way to learn that appreciation.
Yes, I can imagine. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a little quick break. I think somewhere in the machine here, there's a PSA or two that we should play, and we'll come back with Jeff Amy, and we'll get to the book, which is the whole point of what we're doing here, and also throw in a little musical selection. I couldn't find anything about Greatness, Manitoba, obviously, because it's a fictional town, but you got a song here. Is it Faster to Brandon or by Bus by JD and the Sunshine Band? And we'll be back in a few moments on West End Dumplings, the radio edition on 101.5 UMFM.
Bison Sports would like to thank UMFM for their coverage of Bison football and Bison sports throughout the year. For the latest information on everything to do with your Bison varsity athletics teams, go to gobisons.ca and listen for the action right here on 101.5 UMFM.
There we go. We had a PSA, and you know what? I'll play JD at the end of the show. We're having
piqued my curiosity.
We're rolling along. Well, actually, it's a great band, JD and the Sunshine Band. They're based out of Sunshine House on Logan Avenue, which is a kind of a drop-in center for street-involved people. It used to be Cali Shiva AIDS.
Okay.
And
yep.
So they deal with a lot of people that a lot of other agencies don't deal with, people who live on the streets that might have, you know, drug problems, homelessness problems, HIV, AIDS, other diseases and stuff like that. And JD is JD Ormond, and he's in a couple of bands around town, but they put together a musical program where some of the regulars at the drop-in center play some of the instruments and things like that. And it's actually kind of a cool project. Add JD on... When did I have him? Probably back in January or so.
Very cool.
Good. Yeah. So I will play him a little bit later in the show, but we're just flying through this. I thought I'd be itching, chomping to get back at the show. So my guest, Jeffrey John Amy, and he'll talk about his book, his novel, No Escape from Greatness. And so the book starts with the character, Gilbert Pegg.
Mm-hmm.
He's coming to the end of a journey of personal and professional humiliation, ending up back in the one traffic light town in rural Manitoba that he swore to leave and never come back to 2 years before, and set up what's happening at the beginning of the novel.
Yeah, for sure. I think Gabriel believes that he has found the ticket to his freedom, which is finally getting his ex-wife to sign a divorce agreement that will relieve him of celebrity child support. And that I think that idea was ripped from the headlines because maybe some Canadian former sketch comedian may have had some legal troubles because of exorbitant child support payments that were based on his income when he was a superstar.
Okay. Of course, Gilbert is no longer. That's all come crashing down around him.
Yeah, exactly. So Gabriel's got to go in and get his ex-wife, Luann, to sign. And then he thinks that once he can do that, then he'll be able to come back to Canada and have the money to start his new career as a highfalutin auteur of great artistic works rather than the sketch comedian that everyone knows him as.
And, of course, the trap is that it's his daughter that he's never met.
Right. It's like his estranged 11-year-old daughter. He's been too busy to ever meet her. And also, I guess, maybe he was prevented by law from ever setting foot in Canada. So, yes, that is kind of the catch, that he doesn't realize he's signing on for very regular visitation of his daughter. Petunia.
Which traps him in his town of Greatness, Manitoba.
That's right.
So not even just in the province or in Canada, but he's stuck back in his hometown. Now, Gilbert's not a very nice character for
Gabriel.
Gabriel, sorry, for the first few chapters. He's
a little cranky. He's a little L.A.
Self-centered prick, basically, is what he is. And even his return to his hometown, I mean, it isn't humbling for him in any way at all. It's kind of an in-your-face. This signature is going to be an in-your-face victory for him. Going to rub the town's nose in it again. Even blackmails his nephew to come along with a GoPro camera to even film the event.
Correct.
And that when things go wrong for him, that's suddenly he has to be stuck in the town and tries to make lemonade.
Yep.
From what happens and
That's right. And I think he's driven a lot by ego.
Okay.
When he starts out, and that ego just gets dismantled.
Well, and you see it kind of, and he kind of matures. He's like a big kid who's coming off a successful few years. Had that kind of Hollywood yes men always around him to help him out.
And
you kind of see him mature as he tries to write a screenplay about his town and involving people
and
in his
himself.
Town.
And I think that me writing this book is kind of like Gabriel writing his screenplay in some ways, right? Like it was sort of an exploration of, you know, a screenwriter in Winnipeg. There are some similarities.
This would have been, because we said before this started out as a screenplay. So it was going to be a screenplay of a guy writing a screenplay about his life. So, did you want to do a reading for us?
And, sure. Can do. I thought maybe I would just start with the beginning.
There we go.
All right. Seems like a logical place to start. I don't know if it's, maybe I should be more like stodgy about it. And this is page 119 and you require no context. Okay. Here's chapter one. Victory! Finally, after a decade of what could only be described as a Sisyphean boat tour through the nine circles of hell, an inferno so arduous that only the fates themselves could have laid them out for me, finally, I will taste my emancipation. My return to greatness is at hand. I hit the brakes and gravel dust billows through the car, stinging our eyes. I can barely see Zach in the passenger seat as he coughs. "We're here?" he says. "Switch on the camera," I tell him. Zach's got one of those little GoPro cameras the size of a facial tissue travel pack. He's going to film all of this and produce a documentary. It wasn't even my idea. I begin my on-camera commentary. We are in a truck stop parking lot outside of Greatness, Manitoba. Population? I have no idea, but there is one traffic light. We're here to sign my emancipation documentation. As the cloud of gravel dust settles, we see the tarnished tin exterior of the Four Winds truck stop. Before I left this place, the truck stop was a classic diner, clad in reflective aluminum siding like an Econoline camper. Years of prevailing winds pounded dust into her hull and sanded away any protective coating. Manitoba winters did the rest. Like everything here, simply existing was reason enough for the universe to dole out its punishments. Nature herself had been kicking the Four Winds truck stop around like an old tin can, and seeing the corroded, greasy spoon through the settling dust hits me in the stomach like an oil man special with a black coffee. This is Indian summer in Greatness, Manitoba. Stinking, arid, gravel-stained, with a tinge of sulfur and a whole mess of torment. It's a special kind of hot in Greatness today, the kind of hot that Satan himself reserves for only the most deserving. Being back here is hard to swallow, but the heat makes it doubly so. Here in southwest Manitoba, October is like the worst stepdad. It starts off full of promise, but could walk out on you in the middle of the night, and more often than not, it'll leave a beating on you before it goes. The leaves could fall off tomorrow, and Greatness could be under 3 feet of snow by Tuesday. You could be unplugging your air conditioner and plugging in your car's block heater in the span of a week. Today is a hot that sits on you until you can't breathe. If I weren't so full of victorious verve, I would be oppressed by the day itself. I gesture solemnly through the scalding haze toward the diner. Zach pans the teeny camera over as I make a steel jaw and grimly pronounce, "Today, Gabriel Pegg will set himself free. Freedom awaits inside the Four Winds truck stop.
Well, there we go. An introduction to...
Now you can start on page 3.
There you go. There, yeah, first 2 pages already out of the way. So, now, greatness, and you could say small-time Manitoba in general is... I mean, it's more than just a setting. It's almost a character in the story, because really since, you know, there's some great lines about it. I mean, one of the characters says, "This town is where dreams go to die." And also for Gabriel, he says, quote, "I don't hate greatness because hating the town would imply the part of me still loves it. The opposite of love, as everyone knows, is indifference." And he figures instead of calling it greatness, they should have called it meh. Instead, but actually greatness is a huge, I mean, it's almost his nemesis.
Yes.
Ever since he was a little kid, he worked to get out of greatness and kind of even, you know, now it's kind of taken over his life again. And, you could almost say that his fame and fortune had a lot to do with greatness because of that drive to get out of the small town.
Yes, and he almost has to fight nature itself to, because it seems like Manitoba wants to claim him in many ways, and he feels kind of not just stuck but sucked in, and he is fighting that. He is fighting it instead of allowing Manitoba and greatness to kind of, you know, be a part of him.
Yeah, and that's... Now, you have a small-town background. Verdun.
Yes.
And Rivers.
Yes, both.
I mean, were you like him or his daughter, Tune, who at an early age was just fighting and clawing to get out of a smaller center?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually moved from Verdun in grade 2. And one of the reasons why, it wasn't the only reason why, but I did some aptitude tests, and I guess the teacher told my mom, like, if you want to, you know, maximize your child's education, you should move to the big city, which, of course, was Winnipeg. And now that I've, you know, lived my basically an entire life in Winnipeg from grade 2.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Suddenly, Winnipeg is the small town.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. Sure.
And that's really what greatness is in many ways, just a microcosm of the any town, whether it be Winnipeg or Verdun or Rivers. A lot of the sort of memories that I dug up were childhood memories of Verdun. There is not a small part of greatness. More than a small part of greatness is based on Verdun. But I hope that, and when I did the event in Verdun, I was certainly trying to be clear that I love Verdun. It's a great town, and I'm happy to have lots of pleasant memories there. My grandfather owned restaurants in both of those small towns.
Oh, okay.
Rivers and Greatness.
A good friend of mine.
And Verdun,
lives,
I mean.
One of them was in Rivers was the hotel.
Yes.
He owned and a good friend of mine lives in the building across from the hotel, which is still an empty lot.
Is that right?
Yes. I go to Rivers fairly often. So.
Is that right? Yeah. He owned the Blue Boy restaurant that was in the basement of the Rivers Hotel.
Okay.
I think it was called the Motel. Rivers Hotel, I think.
I think it was a hotel. It was an older building.
So. Yeah, yeah. And yeah. I think his restaurant was sort of downstairs, and I'd have to ask my mom about more details. But I think I lived there for a year when I was really small.
Oh, okay.
But I have a few memories of Rivers, but I have lots of memories about Verdun, because I was, after we moved away, I was still there every summer for 3 weeks minimum, and until I was a teenager.
And something that's great in this book as well is you have a great cast of
Kooks.
small town characters.
Yep.
That you know, even, I mean, if you even did work out, drop them in, I mean, you could develop any of those into a novel about the town itself, and even I keep wanting to call him Gilbert.
Gabriel.
If Gabriel left town,
yep.
you still had enough really great characters to work with. And I always kind of think, like, my mom's from a small town in Ireland, so she has great stories, you know, growing up by all these kind of strange people. And last week on my show, I had the EBC Railway Project, who are traveling the rails, going to small towns, and one of them is specifically tasked with tracking down all these great characters that are there. And and I think in a, you know, in a small center, not that the characters are kind of celebrated, but you have no choice but to get to know them and to live with them and to work with them. Whereas in a bigger city, you call the cops on them, or you isolate them, or you just kind of you can afford to avoid them because you never have to get to know them. And I think that's something I love when I read things that are set in smaller towns, is that you get this kind of oddball group of people that in any other setting, in a setting of 1,000 people or more, would never hang out together, would never have to work together on a project. But he brings them together to try to work on this this screenplay.
And that, really, that in a small town, it's, you know, familiarity breeds contempt, but also you have no choice but to hang out with those people. It's like a big dysfunctional family, right?
Exactly.
And I think anyone in a small town or having that kind of exposure realizes that, you know, like, gossip is totally different in a small town, and you don't want to be the person that's the subject of gossip in a small town, because it never really goes away. And but also, you know people and their faults and foibles and maybe more personal information than you would in a big anonymous city. But you also have to deal with these people all the time. And there's something really kind of comforting and stable about, almost family-like about a small town. So, and it shouldn't be, it shouldn't be overlooked. Like, that is, that can be a really good for your health kind of thing.
Well, exactly. Just having no choice but to deal with different people.
Right.
Or, you know, I think cities would be a lot better places if we, sometimes just had to say, okay, you know what, they're different, they're a little odd, but
you know what,
I'm just going to get to know them and work with them and help them out.
You're right. And I think there was a time where we didn't care so much about neighborhoods. And I think we are going back to that in a, even if it's, whether it's an urban setting, or even suburbs, I think, like even the new kind of sprawled out suburbs, people are making an effort to create that neighborhood type of weave. And I think we all realize it's important.
And I think for some guy who would have dealt with a lot of characters in Hollywood and things like that, but, you know, he's come back, so he's trying to write this. He's determined he's going to write this great screenplay.
Yes, and
include members of the community, which means he has to bring all these people together. And that's how you kind of see how he changes and matures. And I mean, I give anything away by throwing things in there, but all these curveballs that they kind of throw him through throughout is how he kind of figures out who he is.
Wouldn't it have been easy for him to have written a comedy? But he's dead set against, he wants to be taken seriously.
But people assume he's right. Anybody from his old life who he meets, as soon as he says, well, I'm doing a screenplay, they all just
potty humor.
Automatically, it's like, oh, well, you know, a comedy. And he's like, it's not a comedy. It's not a comedy.
Right. And I think I spent a lot of time thinking about stereotypes and kind of playing on stereotypes with all the characters and the people in the town. Mm-hmm. In many ways, they each, maybe they don't represent stereotypes, but it could easily be twisted into something that was really kind of, they play on stereotypes. And he journeys through this kind of, almost like, what would you say? Like this arc of comedy stereotypes and kind of the things that we expect from comedians. And he fights against it the entire way. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you've done your reading, and I should say, actually, that I do have a copy here to give away.
Awesome.
Of the book. Your publisher was nice enough to send along an extra copy. So, it's hard. I don't even like using the phone on the show. So what I'll say is we have a Facebook page, West End Dumplings, the radio edition, on Facebook. I'm not even sure how many people are on it, but how many people are friends of it. But you know what? If you go to the Facebook page and say hello or something like that, I will PM you back after the show, the first person who gets through, and make arrangements to drop off a copy of the book with you.
And it's signed.
Signed, and signed. It's a copy of the book he read from.
Yes.
So the author's eyeballs have scanned.
And I'm kissing it now. My lips are up against, you can't see it, but yes, it is a kissed, signed, read book.
Yeah. So in the end, without giving away the ending of the novel, I mean, I think it's, you know, the potential of bringing a family together, bringing a community together, even though he may or may not end up being part of that community. It's kind of interesting what you know. Obviously, the book ends at a certain point, but say 6 months after he decides to go, he's brought a town together, a town that he's hated, a town that he's tried to run away from and stuff like that, is that he's just changed so many relationships and things like that. Do you think 6 months after this book that Gabriel would still be in Greatness, or do you think that he would end up being somewhere else?
Yeah, I think he would still be there. I think he would still be there because I think... you know, he has to figure out over the course of the story how to be himself and his most authentic self. So I think he learned some things and maybe figures out a way to want to be there, possibly. I don't know. Yeah, I could imagine him there for sure. But maybe not, like, under penalty of jail.
Yes. That's right. No, it's a great book. I really enjoy reading it. I love the characters. I loved how Manitoba, anybody who's been to or has friends in rural Manitoba and stuff like that, I mean, you can see that. You can see. And as you said, you can also see it in Winnipeg, that whole thing of, you know, at one point he mentions that, you know, if you don't make it big in the States... still nobody. Even if you're big on the CBC or something like that, you're still not quite big until
someone from the States.
Notices you and things like that and all those little quirks and it was just interesting following Gabriel's journey as he goes through life back here.
Well, thanks very much. It's so easy to slag Manitoba. I think we all have that kind of low self-esteem about where we live. It's the city, but it's also the province. And there are so many great, unique things about Manitoba. And I can't remember who said it. Was it Catherine? Maybe it was Catherine Hunter, another writer. But... I think anybody can love an ocean and a mountain range, but it takes some soul to love the prairies. And that's, I think that rings very true with me, that you have to really know this place to love it. And I love it. I'm definitely a patriot when it comes to Winnipeg and Manitoba.
Oh, that's great. So what's next for you now? You get this
I'm actually working on a secret movie project with a production company in town and hopeful that maybe that will... it's taking my time up right now. I do have another TV series that was part of the National Screen Institute's Totally Television program last year.
Okay. And they have a great website, actually. If you want to watch some good Canadian film, good Canadian shorts.
Yep.
The NSI has some grand. Some of these are just students.
Yes.
That just have amazing short films.
They provide awesome support. And they're a national organization that's headquartered in Winnipeg. So definitely help them out. They're definitely...
They used to do a great film festival here.
Yes, that's right.
That was when I would catch up. Because I do love watching Canadian film. But, I mean, they stick around for a day. Like, I'm somebody who needs... You know, even to go to a festival, it's like I have to start, 2 months ahead of time, start thinking.
Yes.
You know, so a Canadian film, play for one night at Cinematheque or something like that. Their film festival every year was caught up on all my Canadian cinema.
That's good. My wife and I have been going to typically Grant Park, but it can be anywhere. And on Canada Day, we'll go see a movie in the afternoon, Canadian movie in the afternoon.
Okay.
And I think that should be a thing. On Canada Day, go see a Canadian movie.
Yes.
It just makes sense. And you got the day off. So you can go have fun in the evening and drink to your heart's content. But, well, I guess you could watch a movie drunk. There's nothing against the law about that.
And you get things like, the Gimli Film Festival. I mean, how popular that's become in just a short time. And I think initially it was more, just showing movies on the beach. And now it's actually become a huge thing.
They had over 100 screenings.
48-hour film festival this year and things like that.
And that's sold out. I think there was over 100 people at that thing. So,
they're actually becoming, more than just showing films. They're actually even getting, spawning production of new films.
Yeah, and that 48-hour thing is fun. Yes, movie, book, or movie, television show, and a book. I am working on another novel.
Oh,
so
geez.
Eventually I'll get to that, but it's in its kind of early germinating stages. So it's going to be about snowbirds, like the people that go down south for the winter.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah.
Well, great. Well, Jeff, Amy, thank you. It was great to catch up with you after 20 years or so.
We'll see you again in 20 years, Chris.
Yeah, exactly. I'll see you back here in 20 years. So. Okay, yeah, Jeff, thank you very much. And the book again is No Escape from Greatness by Jeffrey John Amie, and that's E-Y-A-M-I-E.
That's right. You can visit my website, EYAMIE.WTF.
There you go. And again, if you go to our the Facebook page for West End Dumplings, the radio edition, say something, not rude, on the little preview I've done for this show, and I will get in contact with you and we'll send you a copy of the book. So coming up, we're going to do a little bit of music here. I promised you something before from JD and the Sunshine Band. And then, you know, I thought I'd play a little bit of, you know, because Gabriel's claim to fame was through a sketch comedy group. So I thought I'd play little bits and pieces from some sketch comedy groups from Canada, some well-known ones. So we're going to have JD and the Sunshine Band, then Ontario Sucks from the Three Dead Trolls in a Baggie, and the Arrogant Worms, Last Saskatchewan Pirate.
Nice.
So that should round us out and give us a belly laugh, and I'll probably just call it quits here. So thank you very much for tuning in this week, and join me again next week. Coming up next is Lyle with Waxy's Dargle, the best in Celtic-flavored music from Canada and around the world. And after that, Gail Comfort with the Comfort Cafe on 101.5 UMFM.
Past your eyes, if you're On Saturday, August 20th, iconic rockers The Tragically Hip return to Kingston, Ontario to cap off the Man Machine Poem Tour in their hometown. But over the years, The Hip have become Canada's band, and coast to coast, we've claimed them as our own. That's why the CBC will be broadcasting the concert live as The Tragically Hip, a national celebration, and the West End Cultural Centre is your place to come together for this special night. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and the show starts at 7:30 p.m., so get there early as space is limited for this free evening that is sure to live among your musical memories. The West End Cultural Centre, Saturday, August 20th. You, The Hip, proudly presented by 101.5 UMFM.
Attention comrades of Canadian DIY communities and underground art scenes.
This is our house, Weird Distro, the first and only not-for-profit online store for Canadian-made cassettes, LPs, CDs, and objet d'art.
One stop, one package, one massive country.
Run by Weird Canada volunteers.
For music to hold in your hands and your hearts, check out Weird Distro at distro.weirdcanada.com.
CN Tower 2, I hate Nathan Phillips Square and the Ontario Zoo. The rent's too high, the air's unclean, the beaches are dirty and the people are mean. And the women are big and the men are dumb and the children are loopy because they live in a slum. The water is polluted and the mayor's a dork. They dress real bad and they think they're New York and Toronto, Ontario.
I think I pretty much hate all of Ontario.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
I hate Thunder Bay and Ottawa, Kitchener, Windsor, and Oshawa. London sucks, and the Great Lakes suck, and Sarnia sucks, and Turkey Point sucks. Moosonee
I took a trip to Ontario
sucks,
to visit Brian Mulroney.
Sucks too.
He beat me up, and he stole my pants, and he put me in a tree. I went to see the Maple Leafs and got hit in the head with a puck.
Brighton sucks.
I don't even know how they did it. I mean, I was playing the organ at the time.
Longpoint sucks and Alan Thicke sucks. Ontario.
Think about it. I think I pretty much hate every gosh darn province and territory in our country.
Well, except Alberta.
Oh, yeah. I love Alberta. Yeah, it's really nice. Lots of cows, trees, rocks, dirt. Ooh, ooh, ooh. But
I hate Newfoundland because they talk so weird and Prince Edward Island is too small. Nova Scotia's dumb because it's the name of a bank. New Brunswick doesn't have a good mall. Quebec is revolting and it makes me mad. Ontario sucks. Ontario sucks.
Manitoba's population density is 1.9 people per square kilometer.
Isn't that stupid?
Saskatchewan is boring and the people are old. And as for the territories, they're too cold.
And the only really good thing about the province of British Columbia is that it's right next to us.
Because Alberta doesn't suck, but Calgary does.
Baby boy, the prince. Meantime, old cats, my role. Extreme entertainment.
Ooh, ooh. This is the way I live.